So, welcome to the splendidly named Meet Two Sons of Different Mothers, which will be a session that explores the genetic inheritance from a common mother. Okay, that's what we're going to talk about. I'm not talking about any sort of IT stuff. My name is Tony Rabin. I'll be the moderator for this session, mostly because I'm the oldest and grumpiest. So I'm splendidly qualified for the task. On the panel today, we have...
Kareem Batish, Group Program Manager, the Exchange Server, Exchange Online team, responsible for storage, high availability, and a few other things in Exchange.
Jeff Mieliff, Principal Program Manager for Office 365 CXP. I do a bunch of work in different areas, but for Exchange, I work on virtualization, storage, performance, Azure deployment, those types of things.
I'm Jeff Guillet. I work for SPS as a principal systems architect. I'm an MVP in an Exchange MCM. I do a lot of pre-sales, architecture design, and some engineering.
I'm Andrew Higginbotham from Dell. I'm a principal engineer in our global support and deployment organization. Also a MVP and a MCM in Exchange. Most of my work revolves around customers who could be deploying anywhere from preferred architecture, physical hardware, JBOD, you name it, all the way to virtualized on SAN. So I suppose I have a pretty broad spectrum of experience of the different types of deployments there are out there.
Okay, so this is supposed to be a question and answer session, but as we all know at events like this, it can be a bit slow to get things going. So we have a few topics that we thought would be interesting just to get things going. And then after that, you have the opportunity to ask these folk whatever you like. So let's start off. Windows. You all know what Windows is? Okay, just checking. So Windows Server 2016 has a group of new high-end features that would be kind of interesting to see in Exchange. So, Andrew, you have a view on this and the kind of features you'd like to see implemented.
Yes, with 2016, a lot of the new just OS features as well as clustering features. Again, in my role, we kind of see it when it first gets deployed for a lot of our customers. So learning about these, I guess, to the Microsoft folks on the panel, would there be any new Windows Server 2016 features coming out that you would be able to, foresee having an impact on the way Exchange is run or its ability to be run either in cloud or on-prem?
So I'll start off. Kareem may have some other things to add. But at a high level, the answer is not specifically at this point. There is absolutely one feature that I'm personally rather excited about and that we are doing some work around, and that's the Cloud Witness. Anyone here actually use Azure today to host a witness server? To be the third site in the DAG? Anyone? I see one hand. Okay. Well done. Not a terribly straightforward thing to set up, and it's fairly expensive to do that. Cloud Witness, anyone here familiar with Cloud Witness for Server 2016? Heard a little bit about it today probably and previously. So much simpler to set up from an Exchange perspective, being able to use it with a DAG to get that third site deployment and automated failover, that would be a huge win. I'm not making a commitment that we will support it, but that's one of those features in 2016 that absolutely makes sense for us to do some work on, and we are actively investigating it. Beyond that, I think the answer there is we tend to not run on the latest and greatest OS for Exchange Online, and I suspect we'll probably talk a little bit about why we make some of the decisions we do around features that show up in the product and how we test things. The vast majority of our testing and validation happens in that large scale Exchange Online deployment. And we need to feel confident in Exchange's ability to use those features. And that means deploying in our own service. We're not there with 2016 today. So if we do get there, it'll be a little while.
Okay. You agree? Everybody agree? Even though Jeff is,
I agree.
You agree. But you're actively working on something.
Yes.
Actively working on. So that means it will appear.
It could appear. we actively work on a lot of things. Okay. Some of which fail, which is why we fail. We fail a lot. We try to fail quickly and move on and do something else that will succeed.
Okay, fair enough. Very good. Okay, so that's the first question we had. Second question for the second topic for you guys, just to give people a sense of the scale that you have to cope with in dealing with Exchange Online. There's all sorts of numbers thrown out.
Yep.
Yesterday at the keynote, I was kind of disappointed that Microsoft didn't increase the public number for monthly active Office 365 users. This was the same number that was reported in May, same number reported in July at 70 million. But still, 70 million is quite a lot. They must have all mailboxes or maybe several mailboxes when you put shared mailboxes and the like in the mix. So what's it like to actually engineer at that type of scale? And what are the type of challenges that you have? And how does it help the on-prem community eventually?
Sure. I'll try to give a short answer.
Yeah, it was a long question. Yeah, I know. But
it's fair. Did you come to my talk yesterday?
No.
All right. So we did talk. I did talk a bit about that yesterday, and it was in the context of troubleshooting an issue.
Right.
And at scale, finding a problem is hard. It's hard to think of individual servers when you have more than 100,000 mailbox servers deployed and tens of thousands of CAS or CAFE servers deployed, along with Microsoft's global network, along with a bunch of owned and leased data centers, different physical buildings. Eddie Fong yesterday talked about some of the issues that you guys may or may not deal with, like data center cooling, and what happens when it's a little extra warm one summer, which I think this summer was hotter than last, and we didn't have the same problems as we learned our lessons and made enough mistakes incorrectly cooling our data centers and incorrectly configuring the physical world around our service. And so the most surprising things about running the service at scale is that we're no longer just software engineers. We think a lot about the physical world, and not just the risks and how we deploy, but where things are, in the case of heating and cooling, where the warm and cold air are blowing in a data center. Apparently, that matters quite a lot.
Well, fluid dynamics.
Yep, indeed. We have many, many engineers thinking about these problems, and it apparently isn't enough. But truthfully, finding problem is needle in the haystack. So what we end up having to do, which eventually trickles into the on-premises product, is build the smarts in Exchange and around Exchange to infer that things are going wrong. So since we design and build the system to expect failure, watching and detecting those new kinds of failures, sort of the new and wonderful things we do, when hardware goes bad, how do we figure it out? How do we try? And one of the big changes that we've made in the last year was open up the hardware that we use in the data center. So there's the Windows Compute Server SKU. We've published the spec for it. Different vendors bid on it, so we're no longer picking one specific hardware vendor. And what that's allowed us to do, or forced us to do in another way, to put it, is look for more generic failure handling in systems that are not just one vendor. I don't think I need to name them.
No.
Right.
No.
So we have to actually have the hardware manufacturers fail in at least consistent ways for the same problem and new and wonderful ways for their own particular issues. And as we make the system self-heal, we can then adapt much better to what's going on. And that's something that's actually a big change in Exchange in terms of self-healing, is actually finding specific hardware failures and adapting very quickly to those things or recovering quickly to those things rather than waiting a long time for those things to cascade into, let's say, database corruptions or other types of issues.
So Exchange set out on this path to self-healing with managed availability.
Correct.
And the early days of managed availability were problematic at times.
You didn't like the blue screens ever, did you?
No, I didn't like the blue screens. How confident are you that you've got now to a point where managed availability really works at massive scale?
I mean, Microsoft puts its money where its mouth is.
It's
simple as that.
That's what you use.
We offer
availability.
It's exactly the same system, yes.
Okay. All right, cool. So what's we've seen some stuff come from the cloud and be delivered for on-prem. What's next? Read from passive was the last feature. What's next? What can people here expect to see over the next year or so?
Sure, I'll start if you guys want to have things that you want to talk that you want us to bring. I'd love to hear about that. But read from passive is an interesting example. It's something that we took quite a while to build. We really wanted to land it in RTM, and it wasn't quite ready. And it involved a pretty fundamental change to how we use databases. So if you imagine the passive, we'd always ever thought of as read-only. Hmm. And many of the features that take advantage of data in the Exchange store are not just read-only. And so we had to adapt many, many different paths to get rid of assumptions that they had had. And we really only did search indexing that way. And we made all the WAN savings and can improve performance, things along those lines. But it's really just one of the features of Exchange that reads data. So we've had that one path. We're exploring many others to take advantage of the distributed capacity that people deploy and take greater advantage of what's available on passive nodes. So if there is CPU, there is I/O to spare on a passive, we're trying to think and build more features. I don't have specific ones I can share because we're still failing at building those at scale and making them work at scale.
Okay.
But suffice to say, for something like read from passive, there's more to come in just that one regard.
So it's things like operational and performance improvements that people can expect?
Absolutely.
Okay, well that's fair enough, okay. So again, we're just warming these guys up, so be you thinking of your questions, because I'm going to be looking for questions from the audience. And no, I'll take one more, and then but you can queue up, and you'll be the first then, yeah. Okay.
Tony, kind of tying off on what you just said there about performance at scale in 365, so the it's coming from a hardware vendor. I believe the famous how big is too big post is about a year old now, the one where the recommendation, the guidance is, you know, don't scale more than 24 cores, 96 gigs of RAM, just to expect the best performance, the best reliability, and so on. You know, as a hardware vendor, it's now becoming a little more challenging to get systems that small with the right amount of options. I know it seems silly today, right? It's just a quick show of hands. If any of y'all had to build an Exchange environment, go through the calculator and realize that you got the little new warning about too much RAM, too much CPU. Gotcha. Okay. So it impacts some folks. So I guess my question is there work being done in the cloud to try to scale beyond the current recommendations so you can still achieve best performance, best reliability? And I know that's a big .NET gotcha there, right? So.
Yeah, yes and no. So I'm fairly familiar with that blog post. It's actually kind of funny. So Kareem manages the team that does the development work on a lot of the relevant components in Exchange. I wrote that blog article. I manage our external facing performance guidance. And my wife actually is one of the performance engineers who's trying to improve things. My wife also happens to be Kareem's sister. So we are brothers from another mother. You can imagine how family, family meals go on Friday nights. Anyway, so to answer the question, yes, we are. So we are in the same situation that you're in, right? We have a hard time buying that hardware as well. The reason that guidance is still out there is the vast majority of the servers that we run in the service today are that hardware SKU. That is the hardware SKU that we are most comfortable with and really understand how Exchange health looks on that box. At the same time, hardware keeps moving forward. We're very much optimizing for cost, right? Kareem mentioned, you know, we have a new hardware SKU that we're looking at that's starting to see deployment. And you can go online and see a lot of specifics about that particular hardware design. It's a lot more cores, it's a lot more memory, and you know, we're starting to experience some of the same problems that we've seen escalations from on-premises from over the last few years, as you've realized why we have that guidance. And so we're now very heavily invested in making sure that we're doing the right things in the product and in the .NET components to make sure that we can effectively use that hardware. It will happen eventually. We will change that guidance, increase those numbers. The caution that I would give you is that if you go out there and look at what those numbers are specifically, don't take that as, oh, that's going to be Microsoft's next set of numbers. It may or may not be. And there are differing definitions for that SKU, particularly around memory. So guidance will change. I can't guarantee when, but it kind of has to. So yes, we are working on it. We'll get there.
Okay, let's see if we can get a couple of questions. You had a question. Will you go to the mic and ask the question and see if you can baffle this brain trust? Let's try one at the start. Okay, let me see how it goes. And if you can clarify your question as much as possible, because sometimes in these events, you know, people get up to the mic and they've got lots of questions and they kind of run all together, and then it's very difficult to answer. So let's see if, give me one issue that you want to talk
to. You guys hear me? Okay. So it's not a technical question, it's more of a strategic. So throughout, as of today, my experience is that most of the sessions topics are more of Office 365, and they are not much covering hybrid or enterprise. So it looks like Microsoft is just focused on one particular industry and completely ignoring enterprise, and I don't see any session. And what I hear, okay, go to particular speakers, go and talk to them, they might have an answer. The problem happens, enterprise, when they're global, they deal with different regions and where they have a data sovereignty issue and compliance and all that stuff. So this is where the problem is. Where do I host my data center? We know you have in Germany, but any global organization, they have the same challenge. And based on that, I have tons of questions. So I would like to know what's your roadmap on that.
So I think there were a couple of questions in there. You got a couple of questions in there. So one of the things probably is at this event, the emphasis that Microsoft is giving is not particularly on-premises or hybrid. It's all about Office 365. So it's very much cloud first, mobile first, et cetera. There is still a strong commitment, isn't there, for on-premises? Do you want to say why and how this commitment is made? And then
just want to ask, there, see a show of hands. How many people are here are Exchange on-prem only? Hold on, I want to get a picture of that.
Okay.
So, thanks.
Well, raise your hands. Right. Raise your hands so they can take the photograph. You know, they want to bring it back and show it to Satya.
Because Microsoft thinks they have a different view of the world.
Okay, you got it. So, you're in a room of your most closest on-premises customers, and they want you to guys to say that things are going well.
Well, I also want to find out, how many people are hybrid? That's probably equal, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, probably.
No?
Less.
I can't see that. I got lights, deer in the headlights. Okay, hybrid having a presence both in the cloud and on-prem. So, and how many people are Office 365 only?
It's three? Probably not. So those folks are asking, what the hell are they doing in this particular session? Because, you know.
Please stay.
Or maybe you're the undecided that we had earlier on today and that needs help. I don't know. But, you know, please stay. You know, you'd be. So anyway, it's a crowd that was attracted here for a very good reason.
Sure.
They want to know what's happening with on-prem. And what I'm hearing is that there isn't a lot of heat and passion from the Microsoft side at this event around on-prem. So what's the truth? Are you passionate? Jeff, are you passionate?
I'm passionate, absolutely.
No. I know you're passionate. The other Jeff is.
Sorry.
Here, the two brothers.
Yeah,
I know.
Am I passionate about on-prem?
Yes.
Absolutely. But strategically, we are very much focused on Office 365, right? That should be very clear. If you're here, you're getting that message. You know, I don't think we've made a commitment around future on-premises versions. We're not quite ready to do that, but we have one in market. We absolutely, you know, support and encourage customers to use it who have a reason to. There are good reasons to go to the cloud, and there are good reasons to stay on-prem, and that's perfectly fine.
Do you know why there weren't more sessions for the on-prem community here?
I have no idea.
Unfair question, I admit. Unfair question. So
I just show up and speak where I'm told.
I know. You do what you're told, and you're very good at it. Karim, do you have anything that you, I mean?
I think one of the things that you definitely saw in 2013, and you'll continue to see through 2016, is that changes from the cloud make it into on-prem. Right. Every once in a while, we'll introduce a change that makes no sense on-prem, maybe breaks things, or exposes a few unusual commandlets, a few commandlet parameters that leak things that we're doing in the cloud quite before they're ready.
Yep.
But our goal is to keep the product the same. As an engineer, the thing that bothers me the most is to support two different product lines, two different series of things. And so we have the core Exchange product, the same one, as you said, with managed availability, the same one that we run on-prem and in the cloud. In the cloud, what we have is a service fabric built around it. The cloud is the place, as you'll hear all the excitement of new features, we roll stuff out first. We screw up first. We scope things down as much as we can first. And then when things are good and ready, we bring them on-prem. As you know, there are features that we build that simply don't work well on-prem or can't be made to work well on-prem, or even make assumptions about, you know, we talk about memory and cores, make assumptions about very specific configurations, very specific networks, very specific groups of servers that if, based on the questions I get about on-prem, if we ever forced on-prem to do, would either put many of our partners out of business, put many customers out of configurations they've already invested in, and would simply not fly. And so in the cases where those differences force us to make judgment, absolutely we'll make the hard call to say we can't bring something into the on-premises product. But really, obviously we get excited about the things that we do first and to show our new work even before it releases. There's many things that we're showing that are even not quite rolled out in the cloud. And it is really a goal to try to make the product the same.
So it's a very laudable desire, a very laudable desire to...
I say as an engineer, it isn't a desire.
It's very hard to fork a product and support two different things.
Yeah.
That's not my question.
Oh, wait.
You wait for the question. Don't be so defensive. No. Right. So it's very... No, it is really laudable. And you know, Microsoft should be commended for running, providing an on-prem and an online version, which are so close. But the real question is, as time goes by, over the next 5-6 years, how close do you think those two versions can be kept? I mean, are they going to get to a stage where they're significantly different, do you think? Or are they going to be always reasonably 80% the same?
It's a fair question. I couldn't attribute a percentage simply because the service fabric that we have outside of Exchange that we use to manage that system at scale is a significant investment for the team. I'd say easily half the work my team does is
on that.
But
let's say the core components, I mean the store, et cetera, it's pretty well the same.
It's the same store.
Same.
It's the same migration service, it's the same Outlook connectivity, it's the same auto-discover, it's the same ActiveSync protocol. Those things are fundamentally the same. I think the big question comes from places where we will try to invest outside of just core O365. We bring a Bing feature in to O365. We can make it meet our compliance rules and regulations. Miniaturizing Bing to run on-premise is not something that we thought about tackling yet, as an example.
Has anybody ever asked for Bing to run on-premise?
No.
So the question doesn't rise.
But many of the smarts that underlie Bing or that power Cortana are things that would require miniaturizing aspects of Bing.
Right.
You know, to have that knowledge, you'd have to go reach out to Bing in the cloud, which I'm not sure people will like, or take the cloud and bring it on-prem. And that becomes the challenge of the next set of intelligent features.
Okay, right? Fair enough. Okay, so is you happy now for the answer? Okay, well, that's the best you're going to get here. Let's see if somebody else has a question. No, let give somebody else a chance. Have we got somebody else here? Yeah, can you come to the mic? Thank you. You'll get back in. Sure. The slow walk as he collects his thoughts, and here it comes.
Got them all collected. So my question is related to environments where, and so this is more of an Office 365 hybrid scenario, or sort of hybrid. You don't really have a full-blown hybrid. The Microsoft recommendation is that if the customer is using Azure AD Connect Sync, that they will have an on-premise management server in order to complete recipient management. That is the documentation that you find online. What I have found in environments is that if they did not have an Exchange on-premise before, the attributes are not there in order for the sync to correctly work. So I put a management server in play, but then everything shows up as a contact. It doesn't understand that, you know, the MS Exchange recipient display type is a mailbox, but it's a remote mailbox, et cetera. And I can't find a way to conveniently, you know, turn 1,000 mailboxes into, you know, remote mailboxes so that they can manage those correctly on the management server that I've told the customer that they need on premise. By the way, I'm Jeff. I used to work with you at Extra Team. I wanted to make sure I said
hello. Oh, well, then that makes it superbly nice that Jeff would answer the question.
So
Jeff, by the way, will answer questions at any time of the evening, provided you fuel him with alcohol.
So in that case, you're way along the road. That's basically reversing a Office 365 only deployment, and you would pretty much have to do a reverse migration, or not reverse migration, but reverse hybrid, where you're promoting, you create a Exchange org and you sync the two together. It's very difficult to do that. And then you're able to manage it, but it's pretty tough. You pretty much have to manage that from the cloud.
Right, but because they're saying, hey, you need, if you're putting an AD sync server right on premise, you gotta have a management server in order to do recipient management. So I tell my pre-sales people, hey, you gotta do this because that's what Microsoft says, they won't support you otherwise if you call them.
Yeah.
So then you're into this situation where it's like you gotta manually try to figure out what the attributes are supposed to be and then go in and try to edit them. And I found, you know, various scripting tools in which I can
so
do that.
So this environment had an Active Directory environment, but no Exchange in it? And then the first email they ever had was in Office 365?
No, so this particular customer was in BPOS-D.
Oh,
okay, wow. So now we're getting into a real level of detail that I don't think we can take in this session. So why I assist you guys take it off.
Yeah, we'll take it.
Sure.
Offline later on.
But that's not the first time I've seen that sort of scenario. The other times it's just maybe they were on Lotus.
Yeah, we call that a reverse hybrid solution or a scenario, and it's difficult to do, but it can be done.
Very well.
Okay,
thanks. Thank
you. So question for you guys. Have you had any involvement with the Security and Compliance Center or the discovery tools with reference to the challenges around indexing specifically when you're getting research results? The TechNet articles and the literature says you're going to get an estimate when you first run a search, and then when you get the results back, we're going to retrieve the message. We get the message IDs when we do the estimate, and then we actually bring the messages back, and there's a divergence. And I've talked to a lot of different engineers and so forth at Microsoft about it, but I'm just curious if any of you guys have delved into that or have any thoughts on that.
So this is the Security and Compliance Center, right?
Yeah, it would be the e-discovery search tools.
Hold on a minute. Yep. So I'm just making sure. Security and Compliance Center, so it's Office 365.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Well, it would be applicable on-prem.
Not really, because the content searches that are executed by the Security and Compliance Center use a completely different infrastructure and completely different technology.
Right, but we did see the diverging results both in the EAC on-prem and in the cloud. But
so can you replicate it with the on-prem e-discovery searches?
I guess my question is just, I guess in Office 365, then in the Security and Compliance Center, have you guys had any experience or any insights in terms of the divergent estimate versus the actual export results and those types of things?
How big a divergence?
Some instances, hundreds of items. So the estimate will say 3,000. It'll come back with 2,700 that are actually exported, those types of things.
Jeff says that seems great. It's a fair concern and problem. The difference architecturally or under the covers between estimate and actual is that when the estimated calculation is done, the query is actually sent straight to the index without any really filtering that happens on the store side. Generally what happens in search is when a query is made, it essentially fans out to two places, the index, and then the results come back from the index and are post-filtered by the store. So what you'll see is an additional set of matches that probably fail once the actual comparisons are made on the storage side to the data. The index only has a subset of columns that are stored for really fast text retrieval, and the store has every other property, obviously, that is used to represent the item. And so when that join happens, and it doesn't happen on the estimate, that join will necessarily filter out items. So if you ever get an exact match, that means that everything was serviced by the query engine on its own. Now, search is a place we continue to invest. We're looking at some crazy new things. Our friends in the Bing team have some great search tech that we are thinking of stealing and borrowing. And we're trying to simplify search by building it closer and more tightly into our storage engine. As that work happens, you'll see estimates and store filtering be the same. But that's really the reason for divergence, if that makes any sense. And I suspect you'll see more divergence depending on the kinds of queries you're doing or depending on the kinds of attributes that get queried. Does that help?
No, it's helpful. And I think for the legal profession, it's that kind of transparency and explanation is very helpful.
Sure.
So thanks.
Cheers.
Okay, sir.
Yeah, hi there. So this is sort of a sort of a follow-up on the AD Connect question. So when we do Exchange implementations or actually Office 365 migrations for customers, we're leaving a trail of hybrid servers back behind, because once we have the AD Connect, it's really just there for management of the users. Do you know if there's any, I mean, what would be ideal is if there were future plans for some kind of write back, so that way you can use your O365 to manage those Exchange attributes and send them back to AD across AD Connect. Do you know if anything like that's in place, or, I mean, is the advice you have to extend the, because most of these customers don't want to have mailboxes on-prem. They would love to have all Exchange on-prem gone, but we just can't do it.
So. Yep, so that's absolutely a complaint that we have heard over and over and over again. Totally get that. So I know there is work happening in that area. I'm not in a position to make a commitment on what that will be or when it will be delivered. Tim, do you? Yeah, there's another panel discussion with myself and Tim Heaney and Greg Taylor and Russ Smith, a few others. Come to that. Tim can go into some depth on that.
Hi, question about health and monitoring for on-premise. Office 365 looks like it has some great tools for monitoring, delving into health problems. What's happening now with 2013, 2016? There's been a recent article about SCOM updates stopping for 2016. What do you guys recommend for monitoring on-premise, some more robust tools, and being able to proactively monitor and take actions?
Well, I think Mr. Higginbotham might have something to say about this, because he recently wrote a book about it.
Yeah, a troubleshooting book for Exchange, but it didn't dive into SCOM per se. So they may comment here shortly on some strategic answers to your question. But I mean, there are certain ways to monitor via Event Viewer, whether it's managed availability and whatnot. But I guess I really have to defer to the strategic answer of whether it's going to be SCOM or whether some on-prem functionality similar to what you see in the tenant is going to show up in the future. I mean, I personally, I think that'd be a good add, because the way I look at it, a lot of the reasons maybe why some of the cool news, the new hotness in the cloud may not come on-prem is because it involves a lot of complexity and a lot of inner working products to get it to work just right so you have a good experience. Monitoring may be one in the roadmap, in my opinion, that would make sense to come on-prem. But again, the strategic official answer.
Yeah, so I can talk to that a little bit. So when we did managed availability, we took much of the smarts that we historically relied on SCOM and other tools. We brought all that intelligence into the product. And what SCOM and products in that category became was essentially an alerting engine, right? We're attempting to find the issue, proactively fix it if we can, and if we can't, escalate that somehow. And that's where things like SCOM come into play. We have our own technology that we use within Office 365 to pick up those issues and do something with them, usually involving a phone call, an automated phone call from our VP waking us up.
As seldom as possible.
Yes, as seldom as possible. That's a good point. not often at all. So that technology, obviously, you don't want to hear from our VP in the middle of the night letting you know that there's a problem with your Exchange server. He will. He's very good about that. So, you know, that's kind of where we're looking for, you know, the ability of a product like SCOM as it continues to move forward to be that alerting engine, but not necessarily to have a massive management pack with, you know, hundreds or thousands of definitions of alerts to look for and ways to deal with that. So essentially what you have today with the existing SCA management pack is sort of the way we look at the world in terms of monitoring the product. I don't know if you want to add anything, but that's essentially, you know, the plan as it exists today for on-prem.
That was his question. I have a question around ActiveSync logging. Why is it that it only stays enabled for 72 hours? I have Exchange 2013. So when you enable ActiveSync logging for a user, it stays enabled for 72 hours and then it turns off. And to enable it, you have to run a commandlet like for each user. And you have to do it on the mailbox server where the mailbox is active in that database. So it's really difficult to put it on for everybody in the environment, and then you'd have to turn it on every 72 hours.
So I was just calling a friend here in the front row, a few other experts, and we're all shaking our heads. We have no idea.
It would be nice, because if you're troubleshooting a calendar issue and it's kind of happening randomly to people, you could just turn it on for people.
Follow up with me after the session. We'll figure out what's going on. All right.
Yeah, I didn't know if it was a performance thing. That's why I thought you might. All right, thanks.
Okay, Pam.
So my question is around Exchange Online Protection. So we run Exchange on-prem, but we were forefront users, and then we're migrated to Office 365. And one of the main reasons we're not migrating our mailboxes to Office 365 is because we don't have a lot of confidence in the spam filtering and the rules. We got a lot of cryptoviruses in through email and ended up running a third party on our transport hubs to catch those. So we don't feel a lot of confidence in relying on totally Office 365. Do you have people working on that, or do you have a comment on that?
So the simple answer to that is yes, absolutely. We have a lot of engineers who are very invested in making sure that we do better from a hygiene perspective. Out of curiosity, so you mentioned you have an additional product that you've added. Yeah. Is that sitting in front of EOP in the mail flow?
No, it's running against the transport queues. It's Kaspersky. Okay.
So your MX record points to EOP,
yeah.
Mail comes on-prem, and then you're taking advantage of
and
that.
And then Kaspersky cleans it from there.
Okay. So yes, absolutely, we are investing in that area. No question about it. Totally aware that that we've gotten some complaints recently. A lot of the customer escalations that I've dealt with in that space, unfortunately, involve people who've lost confidence, gone out and purchased another product, and put that product in line in the mail flow before EOP. And it's very difficult then to convince people that EOP is doing better for their particular use case, because EOP is no longer able to see, as an example, the IP of the connecting, the sender, and using that as a signal. It's an extremely important signal within EOP to determine whether or not it's a legitimate email or not. So we run into that quite a bit. In your case, that's not what we're talking about. We might be able to dig into what specifically is going on there. I have someone on my team who basically spends her entire day addressing these problems and trying to help. So if you want to follow up after, happy to talk further.
One more comment on that, which is we had a situation a couple months back where all of a sudden all of incoming mail was all going to quarantine. So nothing was being delivered and it was all going to quarantine. We weren't notified that was happening. So I opened a case with Office 365, and after spending about 45 minutes on the phone, they said, actually, we're getting a lot of calls, so I think that everything's going to quarantine. But we were never emailed or notified that this situation had happened. Are you guys, when a large-scale problem like that happens, are you starting to notify people? So we had to go through and release every email that came in for a two-hour period. And a notification would have been nice.
Yep. So that's great feedback. And as Kareem said, that's completely terrible. So, yeah, we're both sorry. So.
So okay. We'll the official answer.
Let me.
For those following along at home, is WTF. Yeah. Duly noted.
On our side.
Yeah, no.
So it is fair that when you run into issues that show up very quickly and start to cause pain very quickly. There are situations that we can get into where we're still in the process of identifying the fact that there's an issue and trying to figure out what the scope of it is and get that notification out via Service Health Dashboard. We are constantly working on making that faster and faster and faster and trying to err on the side of notifying sooner rather than, you know, being as specific as we'd like to be. But that sounds like one of those cases where we were likely already starting to notice that there was a problem, but hadn't quite gathered enough information to be able to get that notification out. Service Health Dashboard is where you would see that, ideally. The other point I'll make there, if you don't have the Office 365 Admin app that's available for multiple phone platforms, that's a great thing to download because you'll actually get push notifications from Service Health Dashboard. It's something a lot of people have been asking for, so check that out.
Thank you. By the way, Jeff, the other Jeff is feeling really sorry here because nobody's asking him questions. So he'd like a good question about something like the preferred architecture or deployment or something like that, something to get his teeth into.
Sorry, I didn't have time to work one of those up. I have a kind of a statement and then a question. The statement actually is along the lines of how we started the session. I work in the legal industry, and they're very anti-cloud because they really don't want to be sued for losing data and all those good things. And there's a lot of protection issues and data integrity issues. And someday I'm sure it'll all happen, but that's not anytime soon. So this is about the fifth or sixth Microsoft conference I've come to, and this is not the fault of the panel, but you talk to people that would hear this, whereas I don't. It's really disappointing that every session has to be in the cloud. I understand that technology is moving that way, but looking at the number of hands, I can't even find a Skype session that's not about the cloud. I know how to install Skype, I know how to migrate, I've done it, but I'd love to see something like we used to see. Like, there was this ridiculously complex class a few years back, one of the tech heads, I think, and it was how to integrate SharePoint and Link and Exchange, and it was tedious as hell, but it was great. And I don't see that kind of stuff. Everything I see is cloud pockets of products. And I understand, again, that's how it's being developed, but it's disappointing from the end user engineer side. Anyway, that's not personal, that's just you have ears, I don't. So, the technical question, which I repeat about every other conference to see if it's changing. Any chance we are ever going to have a friendly way to change the attachment limit size for ActiveSync, OWA, EWS, especially EWS? I can only override a web config so many times.
Kill the web lovers in the audience. Yeah. Oh,
wait, you're asking for a friendly way to change the attachment size limit for the various protocols?
Yes.
And right before you said you really liked the session about integrating Skype or Link and SharePoint and Exchange on-prem all together. That was really gnarly and messy, but it was cool that you did it.
It was nice to see someone touch
so
all those
like
things.
It's like the attachment change feature, right?
Yeah. Well, you notice I never did that integration. I just enjoyed the program.
Well, I think fortunately there isn't a class for changing attachment size, but admittedly it's gnarly. No, we don't have any plans to.
So we're going to stick with the web config and better make sure you didn't erase your changes before you did your latest update?
Actually, we've been working on not screwing up the web.configs on updates and configs. Have we finished rolling that out?
Nice.
Yeah, so we've been trying to not, as we would generously say in Redmond, pooch your settings.
Is that going to be official, or just you're just trying hard?
Do you know when we got that, or no?
Done.
No,
back.
No. Yeah, I'll double check on the answer. I don't know when we did. I mean, that affects us as well in our cloud deployments, and we hated that. We hated that we did that. In general, speaking as a recipient of that config override, so I think that's something that I believe we have. So I'll double check, but I'll.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Hello. Kind of a two questions. One was kind of a follow-up to the spam filtering. We're in a hybrid mode right now. And I realize you're working to make it better at catching spam, but what's really important to us is the ability to make custom rules. We can't even begin to move in, you know, use you exclusively because we have rules that like spam that's just unique to us that you guys wouldn't see as spam. So, and I don't see any way to make those custom rules. So is that also part of what's happening? We're going to make it a little more user-friendly. Right now, we're using Proofpoint because we don't have any ability to do that. The mail flow goes to Proofpoint first and then inside, which you guys are trying to get away from. Which, on the second question is, within the last year and a half, Microsoft kind of saw the hybrid mode as a transition mode to full on, 365, and now it's, I hope, that you see it as more as perpetual. So that's the other question is, are you also moving forward with the idea that a lot of people are just going to be perpetual hybrid? So it's just kind of those two.
Okay. I'd like to comment on the opinion the previous person expressed, and then I'll hand it over real quick for the spam question. So the way I've been explaining it to people here recently, it is kind of a shocker to think how fast time flies, but really all this whole game changer about how we use email, where mail is on-prem in the cloud, that's really only 4 to 5 years when you think about it, right? It was 2011, 2012 where this all changed, right? All these different things that have, and really Exchange has changed so much since 2010 came out. All these new game-changing features, and now it just seems like it seems stagnant because it was just so crazy before, right? So you're seeing updates, you're seeing improvements. It's just not as much as the game changer of native data protection, the game changer of the DAG, and all these different things, right? So just think about how far things have changed in only 5 years. So I can't really blame Microsoft for wanting to put their focus on the cloud because that's where they're seeing dollar signs right now. I mean, they're still pushing it. So maybe there has to be a little moment where the scales balance a little ways in a year or two. Who knows? I don't know. Maybe it's full throttle in the cloud and not looking back. I can't honestly say. Because earlier someone also asked a question about why aren't there any on-prem sessions for Exchange. Shameless plug, I have a high availability deep dive session Friday morning. You're welcome to come by. Most of that is almost entirely on-prem. But I guess rounding out the comment is a lot has changed in 5 years. We weren't talking about all this cloud stuff 5 years ago. And there was so many Exchange changes then that every session you went to at one of these conferences, it was just mind-blowing. Like, oh my gosh, the DAG does this. Oh, I can change the way I do backups now. Oh, performance has changed so much. And now the changes are just not quite as much. So maybe there's just not as much to say on-prem as there is in the cloud where all the features are rolling out. So that's my somewhat attempt to back Microsoft to a certain degree here. Spam question.
Oh, thank you.
All right. So so for the question about customizing rules to meet your particular needs that don't kind of fit into the, our definition.
And one other thing, will there also be any plans to take the advanced threat protection and roll that in as well, or is that always going to be a separate product? But go ahead.
ATP on-prem, is that what you're asking?
No, for hybrid at all, any
okay.
version of it.
Okay. Yeah, I'll get there in just a second. So in terms of customizing spam rules, I think the best way to address that is actually to figure out specifically what it is that our rules don't provide for you today, and take that as feedback and figure out whether there's some way we can do that creatively that you haven't gotten to yet, or whether there's something we need to take as feedback to the IP team and try and figure out a way to deliver that. I don't know off the top of my head, but we should talk further. There's a session on Friday, another Friday session, on implementing EOP, being delivered by Wendy Wilkes and Jennifer Gagnon from my team. If you have the ability within your schedule to attend that, that's absolutely the right place to ask that question and make sure that they understand specifically what your needs are, because they're very well positioned to then take that feedback to the relevant development team. With regard to ATP for hybrid, are you not, so what does your mail flow look like today? Are you running everything through EOP and then delivering?
It goes to our MX records point to a proof point and then come inside. However, we're doing a test with this. We have sub mail domains. So we are running a test that's going directly to EOP and comparing the two right now. And
yep. So the functionality in ATP that makes sense, you can absolutely take advantage of by pointing your MX record to EOP, and then once that mail is going through the processing associated with anti-spam, anti-malware, and the extended components within ATP, you're then going to see that mail get delivered on-prem. I think that's what you're what you're looking for.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Next.
Hi. I think this would be considered a feature request, but it has to do with licensing, so I don't know. But we have a client who is in a hybrid configuration with all mailboxes on the cloud. They would like to use archive mailboxes, but they can't. And the reason is, when a user's terminated, management and the replacement for that termed user needs to be able to load that mailbox in Outlook. So what we do is we remove the license and convert the mailbox to a shared mailbox. But when a license is removed, the archive mailbox disappears. So for that reason, they can't use archived mailboxes. It would be great to allow that. I'm guessing as time goes by and storage is cheaper, maybe that'll change, but just a feature request, I guess. Thanks.
I don't know if there really was a question, but I got the feedback
there's a question.
A more creative way about for handling mailbox lifecycle with respect to licensing. I don't know if John is still in the back there. It's a question I'll take to my biz dev guys from a technical side. There's not really much to say. But I appreciate the question.
I mean, one other way of doing that, quite simply, is just to make those, put a hold on the mailboxes, remove the licenses, okay, they become inactive, and then you can recover data from that mailbox straight back into a target mailbox of the new manager. Gets rid of the problem.
Great answer.
Not a lot of work. It's four lines of PowerShell. Come on. Four lines of PowerShell ain't work. It's just an opportunity to excel.
So I want to comment on this gentleman first. She talked about changes. It's good we know from 2010 onwards, 5-6 years, there are a ton of changes from Microsoft 2010, 2013, 2016, and Office 365. So when you talk about enterprise, we already invested millions of dollars, so tons of changes. And then yet to come in the other gentleman, there's not enough stuff on the hybrid. So changes there, but it's still tough and difficult from investment and money point of view for the enterprise. Now, the question is, when enterprise which has a single forest and they're dispersed across the globe in every region, kind of they want to own their particular domains and, you know, all the data. And if they were to go to Office 365 and they say, hey, we want to have our own tenant, how do you think that's going to be workable? Because Microsoft 10, Office 365, single tenant, multi-sites, you're good, you have full administration in the cloud. But what happens if you have single forest on-prem and every entity like Germany, UK, you name it, they want to have their own tenant in Office 365? How's it going to work?
Stay tuned. We have work that has not quite landed there, but you'll be happy.
Yeah, and just to elaborate, this is not just about the data for email routing. They have some concern. Okay, my email within the UK should not go to US, and you know those kind of concerns. And one comment on the preferred architecture, or I just want to add. Let's say there are so many questions, and people are from enterprise, from the exchange on-prem. Can we see something specific on the hybrid? Where we say, I've seen some from non-Microsoft. If you want to do a migration of 1,000, like 30, 40,000 mailbox, let's say, so putting up multiple hybrid servers and the MSRS proxies, so we have to design it. And there are some limitations. So I did not see a particular thing. You go and blog and search and figure out how you change and modify the files. But I would expect is there are some best practices. And you know, it would be good to add that to the architecture stuff.
Feedback taken. Yep. Russ says we have an article, so.
Russ will provide the article later on, sure.
In Exchange 2010 came with a single item recovery enabled, which also did versioning if you enabled it on a user. 2013 and 2016, that versioning went away for calendars and contacts. Is there any plan to bring that back so that you don't, even if you have, you know, four copies of the data, if somebody modifies a contact, that original is gone. You have no way to recover it. What is the, is there a plan to bring that back so that you could truly do a backup-less environment?
So Ross suggests in place hold. that
for
forces
every
us
mailbox.
To save. That yep. It's expensive. Agreed. In place hold.
Well, let's
time-based in place hold.
Time-based in place hold.
Hopefully a quick question for you. Is there any chance we'll get a way to reclaim white space from a database that doesn't involve taking the database offline?
Hey.
Create a new mailbox database and move everybody to it.
Yeah, I mean, ever since Exchange 2010, the mailbox move process is an online move. So, I mean, when it's moving the mailbox, the original's online, the person's working, and it's just a few seconds when it gets flipped over. So, yeah, and like for someone who does a lot of like disaster recovery type cases from customers, like if they had to run an /P or things like that, they don't even recommend defrag anymore. The support statement is just move it to a new database. So, not only is there reclamation benefits to that, if there's any type of corruption issues, I've even seen goofy logical corruption issues within a mailbox, like it doesn't display right, there's odd search issues. Half the time, moving it to a new database can resolve that as well.
Yeah, well, I've certainly solved a significant amount of issues by moving mailboxes, but I'm talking about a use case involving archiving, where a large number of items were removed from a mailbox, but we want to keep the mailbox. And in that case, we want to reclaim the space. Our customers say.
The short answer is move the archive. The story I'll tell you is that we have, for as long as I've worked on storage, tried to do what we call database trimming, which is sorting the white space to the end and making the file smaller. But every kind of problem you could ever dream of happening has and continues to happen. One of the things that we are quite religious about is not losing data that is in a database. And I think the last four tries that we've put into dbTrim has come so close to losing data that we are very shy about taking it and rolling it forward. And I think the answer is the problems that you have around database files growing, having to drain them, we call them overfilled databases, happens sometimes. We hate that problem. It's a very time-consuming, time-intensive process to go and clean up. So if we could trim those databases, we absolutely would. And it's something we continue to work on, and we're never, ever going to ship it until it works perfectly at massive scale, so we can be really, really, really sure we're not going to accidentally delete a mailbox or even a message or an item from that mailbox. So it's one where we are very, very cautious.
Okay, thank you.
But does anybody really care about white space anymore?
No, for us, really, it's only the overgrown database issue.
Okay, I'm just baffled and amused. I thought we'd stop talking about that after probably Exchange 2007 or something like that. I mean, Jeff Goulet, would you ever worry about say anything to a customer if they said, "Gosh, I've got a lot of white space"? Would you think it's something that
actually the only time it comes up is in that scenario where people didn't have archives before. They have archive mailboxes now. I don't have much of a reason to do an archive mailbox anymore. I mean, with the database slider in Outlook, give them large mailboxes. There's really no reason for an archive.
Well, one reason why you might want an archive mailbox is that it can get a hell of a lot bigger than a primary mailbox, at least within the service, not within
We're talking about on-prem, though. I'm talking about on-prem, sorry.
I'm just saying. Anyway, go on.
Hi, guys. I work, my company is in the financial industry, and there's a particular security policy when we receive incoming connections from the internet. They're supposed to be terminated and offed in the DMZ, and then there's a unique security zone over here that's supposed to accept that traffic, which is not the back-end zone, and there's some other rules, which poses a challenge when we build the hybrid connectivity to Office 365. I recently had a call, RTAM set up a call with one of the architects, and we went over a particular topology where we could possibly deploy a dedicated series of CAS servers in a web-type zone, which is firewalled off from the back-end zone. Right, which is not a DMZ.
Yes, it is.
Right, and assuming that we have enough GC cores in that in that web zone. The web zone is its own AD site, and the firewall that would allow these series of CAS servers to talk to the back-end mailbox servers was like a any bidirectional rule. Do you see, if we're going to run it for the long haul, hybrid, and we have that type of security posture to where we don't want to have an F5 and a DMZ proxy straight to the back end, what's your comments? What do you recommend?
Why? So, seriously, you're building a DMZ with a firewall that allows any to any. Why?
Well, there would be like a F5 reverse proxy in the DMZ that would then pass the traffic to a different web zone internally.
Okay. So my basic answer to that is, why not stick that essentially in front of CAS and call that good? You're adding a separate zone that provides absolutely no additional security benefit whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm gonna channel Ross. Complexity breeds failure. Okay, you're making it more complex than you need to, and you're not going to gain anything from it.
And it seems to make less sense now with 2013 onwards, since ultimately the connection has to terminate where the mailbox lives anyway. I mean, I know there's some authentication happening at the CAS layer, but it's not like it's providing rendering or anything like that at CAS anymore. It's ultimately going to the mailbox eventually.
Okay, and last question with that. So you would just recommend a posture like a F5 or reverse proxy in the DMZ and then just pass to the CAS in the back end zone?
Yes. I think you're getting a big correct. Affirmative yes. there, so.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay.
I'm just going to add one thing on there. So that's the way we operate effectively in Exchange Online. That we feel very confident in having a device sitting on the edge. It's not an F5 or any specific brand that I'm going to name, but a device sitting on the edge that is managing load balancing for us in front of what's essentially CAS servers, locking down ports and providing us with all effectively everything that you can get from a layer 4 type of load balancer. Beyond that, we don't do anything else in terms of, we don't do anything proactive in terms of network security. Obviously, we're doing IDS and some other stuff to understand what's going on under the covers and enable us to react to problems. But we're very confident in the security of the product in that type of deployment.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah, come on.
So, question about calendaring on mobile. This is one area where over the years, from 2003, 2007, 2010, we've opened various support calls because some executives would get their inbox completely wiped, recurring calendars would fall off, they go to a different time zones, and time and again, we get from Microsoft support, hey, either use Outlook app or don't do calendaring on mobile. So I guess the question for Microsoft is internally, do all the executives follow the same kind of guidance? And do you think that's realistic, or in the future, is that going to improve?
Yeah, what clients are you using here?
The problematic ones tend to be iOS, although lately with the ones with the meeting organizers getting hijacked, we were told by support it's affecting most of the mobile platforms.
Yeah, so the meeting organizer issues, I think we've licked most of them.
What version of Exchange are you on?
2013, but I've had the same issue in 2010 where the entire inbox just gets wiped.
Because of the mobile. You've heard of it with BlackBerry?
Yeah.
Not to say anything bad about BlackBerry, they're my Canadian brethren.
I mean, there have been lots of problems with iOS over the years. To be fair to both Apple and Microsoft, I think you guys, you've got teams in place that work this kind of stuff out now.
Yeah, I was on the phone with Ed just yesterday talking about Apple. So we meet pretty regularly with Apple and actually have worked with them on making improvements to both their stack and to ours to keep those either bad clients or bad changes from flowing through the pipe and cascading out, doing things like attendees or hijacking meetings.
That's an old bug though now. It's an old one now.
Yeah, no, it's happened unfortunately more than once. From more than one vendor, Apple isn't the only one who has occasionally strayed from the implementation, and we simply didn't always have the protection against badly behaving clients.
Right.
And we've added layers of that, but somehow they seem to find a way.
And to be fair to Microsoft, I think it should be understood that Microsoft has absolutely zero control about how a vendor like Samsung or Apple misuses or uses properly the ActiveSync protocol. They just license the protocol, but they can make whatever calls they want. So the fix is in two parts. Clearly, Microsoft has got the responsibility for bulletproofing Exchange to make sure that bad client calls can't wreak havoc on mailbox data.
Yep.
And you've been doing a lot of that, but you know, apart from that, you've got to keep on chasing those third-party clients to make sure they do the right thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, an attendee taking over a meeting is something that we can stop. A client app deciding that a user with authenticated rights to access a mailbox or authorized rights to access a mailbox, deleting items, that's a tougher one. I haven't heard of that one, but it's certainly possible that it has happened.
Yeah, but Andrew's saying he's heard of it, right?
I guess my point is that there's a lot of, I mean, we understand as IT professionals, we can tell, you know, the users what to do, but is it realistic to actually say to any of your end users, do everything that you want on mobile and mobile comes first, but just don't touch calendars because they're special?
Well, the answer is probably still going to be just limiting what devices can at least initially be allowed in the environment using some means, and have your own little test bed of users. Maybe they are the VIPs. Maybe they're people that you can just kind of monitor their utilization on, monitor the performance coming off of their database and whatnot, and you know, kind of create your own little dog food. Whether that's been historically allow block quarantine, maybe that's some of the other mobile device features and whatnot. Just ultimately, there's always going to be a layer 8 problem that jumps in, or a third party coder problem that jumps in and creates something goofy like taking over meetings.
Yeah, every time there's a major OS release on a client device, you have the potential for a problem. That's just the way it is. You have a potential for a problem.
Should use the Outlook app.
Yeah, and Jeff's saying what I was going to say. I mean, we've made some pretty significant investments into you know, the mobile platforms. You'll notice that this is not a Windows phone. In my bag is not another Windows phone of the Android variety. There is a Windows phone somewhere in there. And we use all of the apps. We use the native sync, but we also, you know, are heavily investing in Outlook for those devices to bring the best possible experience. And calendaring is one of those places where, you know, I'll be honest, I still love my Windows phone for its calendar. But yeah, we use everything at Microsoft, native and our own apps sync happening. And we see the problems and we try to fix them as fast as they happen.
We'll take you in a moment. This is just a follow-up question.
Just related to what he said, when I worked at the University of Maryland, which is a wild, wild west of anybody can do anything with any device they possibly want, and we have to support it, we ended up telling them to use calendars as read-only. And generally, the people who had calendar issues were people who had lots of calendar issues, and those people generally have secretaries. And we make sure that, you know, them and their secretaries on the same version of Outlook have your secretary on Outlook from the desktop modify your calendar. But that solved a lot of issues when they started doing it.
Okay. Thank you.
Sir.
So my question is regarding online archiving. When you set enable a mailbox for archiving and you set a policy to archive, for example, everything older than a year, there's no way to tell it to just archive email. It grabs calendars, tasks, and people aren't too happy with that. So are there any plans to change that or to add that functionality to any future?
Well, what retention tags are you using?
I'm sorry?
Because if you have a default retention tag that says archive everything after a year, that's what's going to happen. So do you have retention tags in the policies that govern things like the calendar?
Well, no, but my point is there's no way of setting up the retention to say just archive emails, don't touch anything else.
Okay.
I don't think it doesn't do that.
As currently what?
The tags that you would add to the policy, there's no tag that says just archive email older than X amount of time, but don't touch the calendar, don't touch tasks, et cetera.
Okay, so you say that the default tag is just taking everything, and you'd like it to be a little less specific?
Like, yeah, a little more specific. We get to choose to just...
Okay, so Ross says it's running by design, but no, we take it. We've only got a couple of... Okay, so question noted, no plans to change at the moment. And I think this will probably be the last question, so.
Just a quick question. So my environment is hybrid and you know we're in Exchange Online, we're very heavily automated. So are you going to be able to bring back the exporting of mailboxes back into scope? Because right now, in order for us to be able to export a mailbox, we need to buy a third-party tool. So is that something that is going to be coming down the pipe?
Exporting from the service, is that what you're referring to?
From Exchange Online, specifically. So we only have G1 licensing, so even though they're in legal hold, if their account is disabled within 30 days, we have to remove that content from the cloud. So for us to maintain our retention, we export that and keep that on local storage. But in order to actually do that in an automated fashion, we had to buy third-party products. So I was wondering if Microsoft is planning on bringing that functionality back.
I don't know if neither of us know of any plans currently to make any changes around that. Just to make sure I understand the scenario, so that the user has left the company and you're archiving their mail to hang on to it for a period of time?
Correct.
Is there a reason you can't just move the mailbox back on-prem?
We could. It just adds extra overhead and just extra...
Yeah, I was just looking for an automatable, scriptable way to do it.
I mean, you could do it through the e-discovery tool, but that's a manual process. So we're trying to look for it so then when a person leaves, it automatically kicks off a lot of scripts and does it by default.
Yeah, not aware of any changes, but we'll
thanks.
Take that as feedback. Thank you.
Okay, so I think we're kind of against the clock. If there's somebody got a really quick question, we can probably take in a 30-second, 60-second question. It's got to be really quick now. Okay, here we go.
Okay. Would it be possible to do a domain name sharing space in Office 365 between tenants and also be able to replicate mailboxes between tenants for mergers and acquisitions?
So I'm not sure I heard the first question, but the second question is it possible to replicate mailboxes between tenants in O365? What was your?
I was just going to say no.
You said no. We actually have a test tool that does it. It's not anywhere close to production ready, so it would really matter what you would do with it. There's tons of security issues with doing that in general, and a lot of complexity depending on how people set up the various roles and permissions. But we've actually looked at our merge technology to see if we can do something like that. Often we've seen I had that request for mergers and acquisitions. And we're actually continually working on better ways to do mergers and acquisitions that may not exactly be replicating mailboxes between tenants, but moving them easily and efficiently.
There is work happening around tenant-to-tenant federation and trying to improve that story. Not the full being able to move mailboxes back and forth.
Okay, with that, I'm going to close off the session because we're up against the clock. Thanks for coming, guys. Enjoy the rest of the night.
Thank you.